Going with Feelings, On Track or Derailed, by Richard Neese, recorded December 1981.
Some time ago, a middle-aged lady, immaculately groomed, was waiting in my reception room, and I met her, introduced myself, brought her into my office. And she sat down and looked directly in my eye and said, "Did you enjoy watching me adjust my pantyhose?" And I thought, I didn't hear that. And so I looked at her in some confusion, and I said, "Would you run that through again? It doesn't compute." Now, I'd never seen the woman before. She'd never seen me before. And that's not my habit to discuss pantyhose with a stranger, or even with those I know, for that matter. And she said, "When I was in your reception room, I had to adjust my pantyhose. Now, you were watching me through those one-way mirrors. I have in my reception room a rough sawn paneling with strips of mirror. It gives a sort of expansiveness to the room. And when she says, 'You're watching me through those one-way mirrors,' I thought, uh-oh." And I said, "Those are not one-way mirrors." Now, the thought did occur to me, if she thought I was watching, why did she go ahead and do it? But I refrained from getting into that. And I explained to her, "Those are not one-way mirrors," and I could show her. And she said, no. She says, "I think you have some kind of a television camera hidden there, and you're watching on television." And I said, "Would you like a personal tour through my office to show you that this is not the case?" And she said, "It wouldn't do any good." Well, I says, "How can you say, then, that I'm watching you if I'm willing to give you objective evidence that this is not the case?" And she said, "I can feel it. I can feel it." Now, you see, this really, a little bit left of center, but does illustrate a very pervasive and popular phenomenon in our culture, which is sort of a mode of living with so many people in their personal lives. You go with your feelings, and it has tremendous implications, I think, for the mental health movement, and that's what I'm concerned about today. The implications, and I could call this a feeling or emotional model of human behavior. And it says, in essence, what is real is not what's out there, is not what's really going on, it's what you feel. And the way to be in touch with reality then is to really be in touch with your feelings moment by moment. Now, in a more strident way, going with your feelings is really the philosophy of a rapist. In fact, those individuals who are given to violence also live by this credo. In fact, just a hothead. And you look around and you see individuals who make so many decisions on the basis of those momentary feelings that they have to go with. They get into marriages on the same basis. So many people today really get married because they have strong emotion and poor judgment. And they get out of marriages sometimes for the same reasons. They don't feel good toward the other person. And when they lost that feeling, you see, that's everything. That's the reality. And so people flit from job to job. They relate to other people on the basis of these feelings. And as a result, over a period of time, such individuals become vulnerable to the momentary disruptive emotions of guilt, depression, fear and anxiety, anger. But you see, this thrust is reinforced by our culture, perhaps more than any other individual to sponsor this type of approach was Sigmund Freud. You recall that his major thesis was that the repression of particularly the emotions of our sexuality and our hostility being repressed by the structures of society, the whole process of psychotherapy is to uncork these repressed feelings. Now, I'm not suggesting that we repress our feelings. I think it's very important that we can acknowledge them and learn to deal with them. Nor am I suggesting that a lot of the feelings that we have shouldn't be developed. The sensitivities, the warmth, the expressions of affection, there's a whole gamut of feelings that is very important to enter into our cultural exchange, our relationship with other people that ought to be developed. But what I'm talking about is this indiscriminate going with feelings, that whatever feeling comes on you, this is what you have to go with. And this is reinforced by our society. Not only through Sigmund Freud, but you remember a few years ago, a very popular Saturday night sitcom on television, the Bob Newhart Show, Dr. Robert Hartley. He was coached well. When you look at the modality of his treatment, you'd hear him from time to time says, well, you've got to get in touch with your feelings. But I assert that's where a lot of people get in trouble. That's all they're in touch with is their feelings. I was, a couple of weeks ago, I was watching a sporting event Sunday afternoon, and during a commercial, I channel flip. I cannot stand commercials. And so as I was channel flipping, I came across to what purported to be a group therapy, and it turned out to be an old movie. Bob, Carol, Ted, and Alice or something. I did not see the movie, but as much as I could gather, they were in this group therapy session, and it was kind of a swinging couples group, and the therapist was getting them all to get in touch with their feelings. Well, it seems to me that that's where probably a lot of their problems stemmed in the first place. Now, again, to acknowledge one's feelings is one thing, but to have them in the driver's seat is another. And in essence, that puts one on some kind of an animal level. As human beings, we are not just like animals. I mean, animals, when they have powerful drives, they must mate, they must hibernate, they must migrate, all on the basis of their urges. And I'm not so sure that this is the healthiest way for individuals to live today, but it is a cultural phenomenon. I'd like to suggest three criticisms of this point of view and then offer an alternative. This is somewhat of a polemic for a point of view which has been of concern to me for a number of years. First of all, this indiscriminate expression of our most imperious, demanding emotion of the moment tends to reinforce those disruptive emotions that are acted upon. And while individuals might act upon some emotion out of relief to make them feel better for the moment, and thus discharging such energy, they do get temporary relief. But what I'm suggesting is that over a long period of time, acting on feelings this way actually strengthens the tendencies to have the very emotions that led them to act in the first place. I remember a colleague of mine was teaching in college, and he was telling me one time how he had some students very angry over some of the administrators of that college. And what he suggested they do is take their pillows and imagine that is the face of whoever they're mad at and just pummel that pillow. Now, that does discharge a lot of intensity that is built up for the moment. But we have very clear evidence that those emotions which are expressed tend to be reinforced, tend to be strengthened. So in the long haul, such individuals become more and more obsessed with those kinds of feelings. And it's like a Pyrrhic victory. You win the battle, but you lose the war. And so what I'm suggesting is that you be very poignantly aware that what you express is going to determine in the long haul what you feel. Secondly, I think it's important to recognize that these emotions expressed this way, as they become stronger, tend to distort your pictures of reality. So if then you are used to living by your feelings, and those feelings get strong enough through repeated exercise, this will color your picture of reality, and thus you have the woman who thinks that I'm watching her adjust her pantyhose. Why? Because she felt it. It was that demanding. It seemed that real to her. And not only will your picture of reality become distorted as you filter everything through your most current emotion, but I think it has very disastrous effects on your ethics, on your sense of right and wrong, which is part of the distortion of your reality. I remember a 15-year-old girl came into my office some years ago, a very beautiful young child, physically very mature for her age. She was stoned when she walked in. She came in and started talking to my wall. And I ushered her over to a seat and got her down and sat across her and started talking with her. And it was very frustrating because I would say something to her and a minute or so later, she didn't remember what I said. But she could say something, and 10 seconds later, she didn't remember what she said. And after about 15 minutes of this, I was getting very frustrated. And I looked at her and I said, "Sweetie, you are crocked." And she got a big grin on her face, and she says, "Yeah." And as I was still somewhat amused, although it's a pathetic situation, before I got the smile off of my face from her reaction, she looked like she had been electrically charged, and suddenly she became very pale. And she looked at me and she said, "How can anything that makes me feel so good be so wrong? Isn't that the philosophy of the Berkeley movement years ago? This fellow Rubin says if it feels good, do it." People are driven, you see, by these emotions. Not only do they distort reality, but their perceptions of right and wrong. And if it makes them feel good, it's okay. I remember years ago reading an autobiography by Joseph Stalin. You remember that chap? And he described a purge in which he had personally masterminded the destruction of over 30,000 lives. And in a very cool, detached way, he said, "It was so sweet. The sleep was so wonderful after I had accomplished my mission, and I felt so good." And this was part of his justification of what he had done. So, not only do you reinforce these feelings by acting upon them, but as they build up, you start to distort reality. And the third criticism I have, and this is kind of the end result of this process, you weaken your capacity for self-control. Some time ago, I was getting my hair cut, and as I was sitting in the chair, there was the obvious sound of screeching tires, rubber being laid on the asphalt, and everyone rushed to the window to see what was going on, and there were two cars that almost collided. They did not, and nothing was wrong, so everyone went back to their stations, and after about 10 minutes, some fellow came in that had obviously been one of the participants in this near collision, and he walked in. He was a fellow in his middle 20s, looked like, and he came in with a sigh. Whew. He says, "I almost got rammed by some stupid broad." And he says, "She went through a red light." So he says, "I don't know what happened." And he says, "I got out of my car and I was livid and I was going to give her a piece of my mind," and then he stopped. Now, you don't just leave a thing like that. You know, people are looking at him. What did you do? You know, he was asked. Well, he says, "When I got over the car and took a look at her, she was a beautiful chick." He says, "I asked her for a date." Now, what if she'd been a scrunched up little old woman? She'd have been ripped apart. He wasn't controlled by any kind of purpose. He was going with his most dynamic gut at that point. You see? Well, is there an alternative? I suppose there are many. I would like to suggest one that over the years strikes me as something that can be very purposeful and meaningful and yield opposite results. Instead of having a feeling model that is oriented toward living moment by moment, I'd like to suggest what I call a value model, which always keeps the finger on the pulse of the long haul, the consequences of our behavior. Now, a value is what's important to you, very simply. And if it's going to cut any mustard in life, if you're really going to justify its importance, a value ought to some way be anchored to some kind of consequences that can be checked outside of one's momentary feelings. You know, see, for the moment, our feelings can be very disruptive. They can be very deceptive. And we have these two ways of deciding. Do you live for the moment, whatever grabs you most powerfully? Or do you live for the long haul on the basis of what your values tell you is going to work out the best? This permits a certain maturation where you start to pay attention to your environment and what's going on. A good way to illustrate the difference between these two models is what can be called the student's dilemma. Let's say you're in school. It's Friday afternoon. You have a big examination coming up Monday. If you really get your nose to the grindstone, you're going to pass with flying colors. At least you anticipate that consequence if you put in that kind of work. But your friends have a condo at Mammoth, and they invite you to go skiing free of charge. Now here's the dilemma. If you live for the moment, if you're going to go by your feelings, you know jolly well what you're going to do. But then you're dead Monday. But let's say you have a value and let's say for the purposes of this illustration, that passing that test is very critical to your grade and eventually to your going on, say, with graduate school, professional school, whatever. Now, if it's important to you that you get somewhere in the long haul, then you see that value will help you transcend that emotion. You say, look, I do feel this way. I would really like to go. But I purpose to do something else because it has a better payoff. And yet individuals today are not being faced with that. What are they being faced with? Going with their feelings. They're being faced with the alternative of, well, take for instance some of the reinforcing elements in our society that create this kind of a dilemma that in a sense make one prone to live for the moment. I think a lot of the musical forms are designed to intensify that moment. Now, there's nothing wrong with having an intense moment, but you see, people start living by those intense moments. There are individuals that their way of getting an emotional fix is through some exciting entertainment. And they learn to live from one emotional fix to the other. And that doesn't mean that I'm knocking entertainment. But you can see all of these strands in our society that condition us to live moment by moment. Our feelings are everything. After all, isn't it a very productive pharmaceutical industry that is kept going by the fact that people have to feel good? If you're down, you take an upper. If you're up, you take a downer. But you've got to feel good. That's better living through chemistry. And of much chagrin to me, the profession which I identify with is very concerned with helping people to feel good. Now, there's nothing wrong with feeling good. But the thing is that most of the people who come to a mental health professional are more concerned with feeling good than with being good. People come to pay me for relief, not change. And you see, we have this exalted image that we all must feel good, but sometimes, say, maybe taking some responsibility could be a pain in the neck. Well, what are you going to do if you live by your feelings? So this alternative model that I'm suggesting calls for individuals learning objectively what is important to them and what's going to help maximize the long-haul consequences. Now, let me further illustrate by three of my values. I'm not saying you should have these values. We don't have an IBM card that say, here are your values. This has got to come through your learning experience, what you've learned from your past, what you learned from other people, perhaps some kind of approach, some philosophy of life that would influence what is going to maximize the best consequences in the long haul? have a value that I can state this way, that marriages ought to have a great deal of affection in the interaction. Now, that's no problem when you're first married. When you're dating, when you're getting acquainted, when you're courting, that's fun. But it's very easy over a process of time to start taking each other for granted. But I assert that if you want to keep those feelings alive, and that, I would say, is an ethical basis, not just because they're feelings, but because they're healthy kinds of feelings, that those ought to be expressed. That is, you ought to be affectionate in a good relationship long haul, whether you feel like it or not. Now, some of you are going to think about that and say, that sounds a little raunchy. I'll get back to that in a moment. All right, but the problem here, you see, you just don't always feel like it. You cannot go around in a 24-hour romance. I know some days at my office I feel like I've had 24 quarts of blood drained from me, and I don't have 24 quarts of blood. And I go home and I feel like a zip. Now, it's sort of like I paid my dues. I've listened to everyone else's problems. I ought to be able to grumble a little bit. I ought to be able to walk through that door and say, get out of my way. Don't bug me with any problems. Now you bow down to me, as it were. That's the way I feel. But if I'm going to live by my value, I'm going to walk through that door and I'm going to put my arms around my wife and I'm going to give her a hug and say, sweetheart, I'm really glad to see you. Now, I don't feel any surge of emotion, you understand. Although, interestingly enough, if I will do that, I'll feel a lot better than if I didn't do it. Now, that's kind of a paradox. You try to feel good, and you're going to wind up feeling miserable. You try to live by your values and manifest and maintain positive behavior in line with those values, you're going to wind up feeling better than you ever would have felt if you were trying to feel good. And besides, that makes for stable relationships. Why is it inappropriate to act responsibly to another human being just because you don't feel like it? I have another value, that we ought to act with self-respect. Now, what basis do you act with self-respect? Well, there are many things that feed into this. But one aspect that's very important to me is that someone cares about me. That's very important. I am somewhat of a religious person. I have a belief in deity. I'm not suggesting that you're a twit if you don't, but I'm just telling about my own value structure. And I think this deity cares for me. And unless I am going to assume he has bad taste, I ought to act accordingly. I think my wife cares for me. I can point to a number of people who care for me. I think that makes me special. Now, I don't have a yacht, so I can't get my specialness from a lot of things that some people do. But Dean Martin, or no Dean Martin, you're nobody until somebody loves you. And I think somebody loves me. Now, there are times, and this is the problem, where I don't feel loved. So what should I do? Should I go around acting hopeless, helpless, and worthless because I don't feel that? If I can stand apart from myself, if I can look at my values and say, wait a minute, I've already decided that I have worth, then I can transcend that feeling which says you go around act like a nerd because you are a nerd. And I say, no, I'm not. I feel like a nerd at that moment, but I'm a person. And so that means that it becomes possible. Not that I'm going to do a rain dance or do cartwheels, but I can act in a way that's opposite from just being a cipher. I can be friendly. I can be attentive to other people. It's a little rough, but I'll tell you this, that's better than working yourself into a snit. And that's what you'll do if you start acting like you feel. I have another value. I think that other persons have worth too. Not on the basis that a society says they have worth, but I think that they have worth on other basis. But I don't always feel like treating them like they have worth. Let me give you an example. Here's a lady that comes into my office. Never saw her before. She sits down opposite me, and she looks at me, and she says, "I don't like you." Well, I said to her, I said, "I don't think you know me." And that stopped her for a little bit, so chalk up round one for me. But then as she thought for a bit, she looked at me and says, "But I think when I get to know you, I'm going to like you even less." So I got I got cuffed around on round two. Now, I'm not developing a real strong case of likes for this woman. I don't think I deserve that. But, you know, she's really letting me have it. So I said, sort of surmise here that you don't think too much of men. And that was the trigger that set her off. And she, the tapioca hit the fan at that point. And I mean, she blistered me with 4 and 5 and 6-letter words that I'd heard before, but I'd never heard them in that those combinations. I mean, she was furious. And I didn't like her. My feeling was I'd like to show her quickly how to get to the door and give her a quick roadmap of where to go. But I'm not going to do that if I really basically have respect. Now, I also don't believe I'm going to be a doormat either. I have self-respect. But I think I should treat her as having worth too. And that's not a bad definition of love, by the way. You treat persons as having worth. And you're a person too, you know. If you have some value that gives you some meaningful sense to do that. But why do I have to like her? Why can't I treat her as having worth, even when I got the yucks toward her? You see? Now, the biggest complaint to this approach is people say that's phony. How can you behave so objectively when you feel so cruddy? Now, of course, that's based on the idea that your feelings are the modus operandi of the way everyone should live. That's reality, you see, what you feel. You see, that's quite the posture of self-centeredness. You know, the whole world must be judged in terms of how I feel. It gets you into an awful lot of trouble. And I would argue that you cannot have stable relationships if you go at it on that basis. But doesn't it sound phony? I think you'd have to admit it does on the surface. Well, let me pull this together by another illustration. A number of years ago, it was a real challenge I had to meet with a lady who was suicidally depressed, who in her middle 50s, you would swear she was 30 years old, a very well-preserved, charming lady who had been in movies years ago. And when I was a kid, I used to run away from reality, and I hid in a lot of flicks on weekends. And so I saw a lot of her pictures. Now, this was back in the days, see, when you couldn't use any provocative words on the screen. You know, the worst word you could use was piffle. I don't know what that means. But even if you were married in your roles on the screen, you still had single beds. You remember that was a very conservative age. But she went as far as the law would allow, as far as her being sensuous. I mean, she was one seductive doll. And she didn't leave anything to the imagination. You know, I was a young kid with my eyes popping out, seeing all that stuff on the screen. And anyway, she turned out to be very cold in real life. Now, the occasion of her seeing me is that 2 months prior to that first session, her husband had died, and she was alone. Now, why would a lady like this, who had so many people in her lives, be alone? Well, it turned out, when I got a history of her, she came from a family that was very well-to-do, and she was spoiled rotten. Everyone would bow and scrape to her and give in to her, and she just learned to do whatever she felt like and let the chips fall where they may. And when she got into movies, she rose to the top fairly rapidly. She made a lot of money for this studio, so she got the red carpet treatment from them, too. She really never learned to be nice to people. And then when she left this industry, she retired very early, a very wealthy woman. since she didn't really do anything for anyone else, wasn't making any money for them, everyone dropped her like a hot potato. And, of course, she became very cynical about this. She didn't believe that she had anything to do with this, and why should anyone not like her? And she became very bitter, very withdrawn, and the only one she had was her husband, but she was able to manage with him. And when he died, she was terribly alone. And no man is an island. You cannot live apart from community in some degree. And so, as a last ditch stand, she came to see me. Now, obviously, one of the things that has to be done if I'm going to save this woman's life is to get her back into community. But she hadn't really been in community. She could be part of the lonely crowd. People bound scraped to her when she was popular. But no one really related to her as a person. She was an object. She made money for people. But that's the way she functioned. She expected everyone else to bow down and let her walk over them. And when they wouldn't do it, she would have nothing to do with them. Now, the biggest barrier to her doing this was her tongue. It was a two-edged sword. She could chop, chop, chop just like that. Well, it became very evident that it was very difficult for people to relate to her. Now, I function really more as an educator than as a shrink. And so, from time to time, I give assignments. And we set goals, and one of the goals was that she was going to learn to communicate with other people and not chop, chop, chop. She had a forked tongue. So, as part of a first assignment, there are other things, but I'm just focusing on this. I said, is there anyone in your life now that you can say anything decent about? And she thought, she thought, she thought, you know, and the time went, and she thought, she said, oh, I know, my valet. Okay, tell me about your valet. This was about 10 o'clock in the morning, as I recall, when I saw her. And she says, well, he's out at Farmer's Market doing some shopping for me, and he's a very quiet man. He chauffeurs her around. She does her shopping, and she says he anticipates my needs. He's always Johnny on the spot. He's there when I need him. He's even there when I don't need him, and he's just always looking out for me. And she said several very nice things about him. I said, have you ever told him this? And she says, of course not. I pay him well. Well, I says, I want you to tell him. And she looked at me, and she bristled. And she says, I will not. I says, why not? She says, because that's phony. She says, I'm not going to tell him if I don't feel like it. I says, that's interesting. You're a former actress. Tell me how you learned your lines. Now, she loved to talk about herself. And so she told me how that she would practice in front of a mirror. Give her gestures, you know. I mean, she's a very accomplished, charming woman when she acted. And then she would record her voice at the studio and she would listen to every nuance. I says, that's a little bit awkward, isn't it? Oh, she says, yes, if you're a good actor, a good actress. She says, you really go through a lot of agony learning your role. Well, I said, now let's say you've learned your role. And they're taking pictures, and I referred her to a few scenes that I remember, and I said, I would be devastated with all those lights on me and people watching me and trying to make out with someone else. I said, don't you feel pretty awkward, feel pretty Mickey Mouse? And she says, oh, no, no, no. She says, once you learn your line, she says, you live it. And she says, you feel it. Well, with that, she fell right into my trap. And not being too smooth about things, I could not hold back a great big grin that went from wall to wall, and she looked at me sort of, well, you irreverent slob, what are you grinning at me for? And finally, it clicked. She says, oh, I think I see what you're getting at. I says, not quite. You've been talking to me about playing a role. It's not you. It's someone pays you to do it. You play a role. But you've just explained to me beautifully how that if you act the part, just because someone pays you to do it, even when you didn't feel like doing it, you act the part, you get to the place where you feel like it. Now, I said, that's not what I'm talking about. I want to talk to you about taking a role, not playing a role. Is it important to you, I said, and this is what a value is it important to you, this is one of the goals we'd had, is it important to you to be a kind and caring person? And at that, she looked at me and she said, desperately. All right. If that's really important to you as a human being, and if you can see that that's going to have payoff, and you simply go by your guts, I said, you're on the same level as an animal. I said, if you really want to be that kind of person, I said, it's phony for you then to go by your feelings. Why don't you go by your purposes? Now, I said, look, you're going to be infinitely better off by functioning this way. That's a good value. It's going to put you back into community. It's going to pay off. It's got nothing to do with how you feel about it now any more than you had to feel when you start playing a role. I'm talking about something that's much more vital, taking a role. You see, this is the issue. You don't know where you're going. You don't have any sense of identity. No one does if they don't have a set of values that they can live by. And those values ought to be constantly updated as you get new information and new understanding. But you cannot just mate and hibernate and migrate like an animal with urges. You have to have values. And when she accepted this, and as an actress she could see this, and as she participated in this kind of a process, learning to act out her values instead of her feelings, the upshot was just the opposite of the criticisms I had of the feeling model. That is, as she engaged in positive behavior that were the reflection of her values over a period of time, which is a law that you're psychologically you're going to feel as you consistently think and behave, she got to the place where she was feeling much better about herself and other people. Secondly, not being so super sensitive anymore, getting other people to respond to her differently, not just simply consulting her momentary emotion. She started seeing things with a clearer picture. She wasn't weighing everything with her emotional thumb on the scale. She got a better picture of reality. Right and wrong was no longer just some current upheaval going on inside of her, but it was an objective picture of what's really best. And furthermore, she developed a self-control that she'd never had before. I raised the question in my lecture title, Going with Feelings, On Track or Derailed? My answer is derailed. But to one who goes with viable, rational values, keeping their finger on the pulse of the long haul, I would say to such person, on track.
You know, when you said about, you know, going with your values, I agree with you, but I was also feeling what came up for me was that maybe those are the true feelings someone has inside, not their impulsive feelings. Perhaps your deep, true feelings are the same as your values.
If you have functioned that way for some period of time, yes, your feelings will start supporting you. But you see, there are any number of things that can temporarily upset your feeling tone. You could pick up a virus. You could miss sleep. You could just any number of situational or physical insults to your system, and you can feel raunchy. See? So at that time, your feelings are clobbered. Now, what I say is that a person who behaves in a certain way, a person who's brought up in a setting where they really learn to behave responsibly, not just momentary feeling-wise, you will get to the place where those become your truest feelings. See, I think to a greater extent than we realize, we can become somewhat architects of our own feelings. Now, that's not perfect, you understand, because while I say that the psychological law is that you will feel as you consistently think and behave, you've got to understand there are other variables that will temporarily upset those feelings. And furthermore, our genetic code gives a certain reaction potential that we might tend to feel differently. But by and large, through the process of learning, the way you consistently think and behave is going to be the biggest determiner of your feelings. So that the upshot is you can get to the place where living out your values is doing what comes naturally to a great extent. And that then would reflect your deepest feelings.
Is that why you said when you feel good, you know, let's say you walked in with your wife, you were upset from work, but when you showed affection, that really was your true...
Oh, yes, ultimately it is, because it concords with my values. But you see, if you don't have a sense of identity and know what's important to you, and know the kind of person you want to be, you're going to be a walking civil war. See?
I would just like to comment that I think it's important to be aware of what your values are, but I also think it's very important to be aware of how are you feeling and what are your conflicts that are coming up, maybe what are the disagreements that you're having, and I think to act differently, to pretend that, in fact, I think there's a difference between knowing what your feelings are and acting impulsively.
I agree.
And I think that
that's a good
it's very
point.
Important.
Yeah.
I think to... If you come home and say, look, I had a really bad day, and after I unwind, I can respond to whatever
it is,
and to pretend, I just, you know,
yeah.
disagree with
no, that. This is quite correct, and that was implied when I said that I'm certainly not suggesting that you repress your feelings. I think they should be acknowledged. And there are times, I would even go further, where even the negative feelings need to be expressed, but they can be expressed responsibly. See, and I'm not dealing with that now. I'm just simply speaking of a cultural phenomenon. But this is true. In fact, many times I'm with a person who's in some kind of emotional difficulty, I want a very clear statement of what they are feeling. But you see, sometimes you have to distinguish that from some kind of objective reality, because let's say, you know, a person who's having a lot of paranoid ideation, they feel that the communists and the CIA have a 24-hour surveillance on them, say. There are times we all feel that way in some degree. You know, you can, on a day that you're really down, you can kind of feel like everyone's out to do you in. But sometimes to categorize, say, feelings from, say, a larger picture of reality that you've already established and say, all right, let's say at the end of the day I'm zonked and I feel like I should, you know, it's my job to keep Southern California from falling apart and I'm failing. Well, at those times, to recognize that I feel that way and that it is a feeling, but it's not in itself reality, and then to be able to tell myself something objective, well, I'm fatigued, I'm tired, but that really isn't the story of my life. That really isn't what is going on, see? And I couldn't do that if I did not objectify my feelings and be aware of them. So you're quite right. But what I'm objecting to is that when I say I feel this way, then people look out because I'm going to do exactly what I feel. And there are many people today that really believe that that's where the reality is, and that's what I'm objecting to. Okay?
What about someone who's not sure what their value system is, someone like an adolescent who's going through the period of forming their values and really has no firm cognitive base of what reality is for them?
Yeah, someone's got to get them into a learning situation where they can be taught. But there are two ways of doing this. You can just impose them on it, which really means you're saying, here's what I believe, now, Buster, you better believe it. But that doesn't usually cut too much mustard with most of the kids today. But another way to do this, and I do this all the time, particularly with either individuals or in a group situation, you talk with high school youngsters and you say, all right, look, here's the way you feel. You know, they get angry and they have all kinds of feelings. Now, I said, let's look at the long haul. Let's consider what options you have, what choices are available to you to make. And first of all, we identify those. Now the question is, usually what they do is they go on the basis of their most powerful feeling. They say, well, now let's hold this. Let's consider all of the consequences, not just the immediate ones. What do you think might happen if you did this? And you get them to start thinking of the implications of the effect, reasoning from cause to effect. And then what happens if you can get them into this process? As they begin to see, hey, right now, you know, I feel uncomfortable doing this, but overall, I'm going to be better off if I do this than if I do anything else. That becomes important to them, and you develop a value. See? Now, little kids, of course, you grow up in a family, and they learn values. You don't do this, or you'll get clobbered, or there are any number of ways of reinforcing it. But ultimately, the most viable, meaningful values are those which make sense to you, those which allow you to take responsibility for your own behavior so that you can say, look, I have a choice of at least some available consequences as a result of my behavior. Now, when one learns to do this, then certain kinds of behavior, certain ways of functioning become important because of their consequences, and you have a value. Do you see? Okay, now I've just kind of said in 25 words or less what this process is. But that's where I would speak to that particular point.
Is this true? You can't control your feelings, but you can control how you respond to them or how you act?
Yes, that is true. That's an important point. If you could control your feelings, guys like me would be out of business. Yeah, you just get up in the morning, and no matter how rotten the day was, you'd say, I'm going to feel great today. That's it. Now, there's another implication of this. If you cannot control your feelings, we have to say that feelings, then, are ethically neutral. There's no moral value to be attached to feelings. Now, that's important because a lot of people feel terrible because they have certain feelings. Now, you can't always help some feeling that you can have, but with a certain amount of developing discipline, you can learn to have some managerial control over what you think and what you do. So we can hold people responsible for thoughts and behaviors, but not for feelings. And I think it's really sad that, say, a youngster will come home and he's mad at his teacher. You know, so Miss Jones is an old bat, you know, and says, well, you shouldn't feel that way. You've heard that, you know, you shouldn't feel. Well, why shouldn't you feel that way? Why aren't there times when people are going to feel afraid? They're going to feel angry. Why can't you feel those things? Many times I'll say to the people I'm working, I herewith give you permission to feel angry, but I would like you to, I'd like to talk to you about acting responsibly about it. You see? So when you have these feelings that encroach upon you, and they do, I mean, you're bombarded. You know, this is kind of a future shock, as Alan Toffler says, that we all live in. You're bombarded by all kinds of things that trigger off certain kinds of emotional reactions. But, you know, it's devastating to think that you're the sum total of your feelings because they're dependent upon your learning experience and what kind of thought patterns you have. You can feel pretty raunchy and you say, gee, you know, we're all potential murderers and everything else then. No, I'm saying that you are not just what you feel unless you choose to act on them. You are what you choose to think and behave.
Do you feel that people have, in general, many values, few values, or just value indicators?
Well, most people are very inexplicit about their values. It's really tragic because I would say the most powerful value today to most people is to feel good. But that value, I would argue, cannot be defended if you think about it because it leads to the worst consequences. Now, what I wish that was done more in my profession was really to function, not curing people from some kind of emotional disease, unless they have physical pathology. I'm not curing someone. I'm a teacher. I'm an educator. That's what you folks are, basically. And I think that what I try to do is help people to refine and to modify and to enhance some kind of value structure that is based upon experience that can be checked. I think that a value, if it's going to be worthy of its name, ought to be referenced to something that we can check. That, in other words, it has certain consequences that follow from it that we can assess. Isn't that the way we learn? I mean, you do something, you have certain consequences, you say, boy, I don't want to do that again. Or, that's really cool, see? I mean, and we learn from other people's experiences. But I think, for the most part, I think that most people's values are pretty much implicit. You sort of learn what's important to them by seeing the way they function. What I say with most people is you kind of derive the notion that what's all important to them is how they feel. But very few people can explicitly tell you what's important to you. That is, in the cross-section of society. Okay?